We're on now.
Okay. I would like to call to order the task force on class size for Wednesday, July 27th. And I want to welcome everyone who came today. Thank you very much for being here with us. As you know, this is our second meeting, and we are going to be going through the agenda as presented in front of you. If you have anything you'd like to add to the agenda or anything you are questioning us about as far as wording or something, please feel free to let us know if there's questions about that. We're going to start out, though, with answering outstanding questions that the committee had from last time. And we're going to start with Brian Reeder and Richard Donovan answering those questions. So if we could go, please, to Brian first.
Okay. There were a lot of data questions from the last meeting, and I wasn't able to get data on for all of the questions. But I did bring a few things, and I think you have copies. The first one is a couple of graphs, one that shows the relationship between, and these are for high schools, looking at just core subject classes, so math, English, science, and social studies classes, and looking at the relationship between average class size and the overall enrollment of the school district, just to see what that relationship looks like. And you can see that that line is pretty much all over the place, a lot of up and down going on there. But you do see a trend where larger districts have larger class sizes. And, there could be a number of explanations for that we haven't dug into yet. What you do need to know is down at the low end for really small schools or really small districts that have really small schools, they get a lot of extra money through the state's funding formula for being small. And so they have class sizes in the range of 5 to 10 students per class, and they can afford that. Having a teacher for just 5 students rather than 20 some students, because of that extra money that they get, what we call the small remote school adjustment, sometimes called the small school correction, which in essence gives them more weights in our funding formula. Because of their smallness, for the very reason that it's very hard to have large class sizes in really small schools. I mean, we have some schools that are only 10 to 20 students in the entire school, and particularly in a high school, since you're teaching different subjects in different classrooms, you're going to have these really small class sizes. It's really unavoidable.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Yes, please.
Those adjustment funds,
mm-hmm.
Where do they come from?
They come from the state school fund.
And are there any types of matches around them? Federal dollars or, I don't know.
No, there are no match requirements. In fact, the money that districts get through our funding formula, with a couple of exceptions, have no strings attached at all. They can spend those dollars any way they choose.
Would you be aware if they were to be receiving any kind of outside federal dollars, would that be information available to you?
Yeah, we know how much federal revenue each district gets, but none of the Oregon-specific money from the state is tied to any match, either by federal funds or local funds of any sort.
So none of these smaller schools receive federal types of dollars just because they're a small school?
I'm not aware that the feds give out grants for smallness. Most states don't. A number of western states do, because they're in the same situation Oregon is in, where they have remote areas of the state that have very sparse populations, so they have very small schools. I think Montana and Wyoming do a similar thing to Oregon. As you get further east, you just don't see these really small school districts like we have in the West.
The small schools correction is a weight akin to like an ELL weight, or the way that you get a quarter weight for a student in poverty. The small schools correction is a factor in the formula in the very same way. It's a one weight factor.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the bottom graph on this page is one of the other requests, which is to look at the relationship between class sizes and high school graduation rates. And again, this is the class sizes of core subjects in high school. And what we see here is, again, they're all over the place. And in this case, if you drew a trend line through that, it would be slightly downward sloping, saying that as in districts where class sizes are larger, their graduation rates are slightly lower. But the effect is very, very small, and it's not statistically significant. And as an analyst, what I would say about this is that there are so many things that affect high school graduation that picking out one and looking at that relationship doesn't really tell you much of anything valuable. What you need is a model that takes into account all of those factors that affect high school graduation and look at them together. So that's the first piece that...
Can I ask a question about that comment?
Sure.
Well, first of all, I mean, you can see that the larger the class gets, you know, whether it be, you know, a 10% or a 5% or a 6%, to those students that didn't graduate, it's probably significant. And to their families, it's probably significant. But a comment that you made about the variables, you just got done saying, well, we'd have to look at all the variables together to make it reasonable to understand the data. The data here on class size says that it has some effect. Whether it's 10% or 9% or 5% or 2%, it has some effect. So can you, if you cannot work on all factors at once, or if you are going to try and prioritize factors, have you taken the other factors or variables that you say are important, whether it be trauma or whether it be absenteeism or whether it be you know, whatever you say those factors are, and have you pulled out a graph for each of those as well?
At the department, we have done some work in looking at multiple factors simultaneously and their impact on high school graduation, and we do that at the student level. We have not included class size as one of those factors at this point in that work, but we can. You run into some fairly difficult statistical problems when you start combining student level data with either classroom level data or school level data. There's some statistical problems that arise. These are fairly complicated statistical models that are able to take into account many factors at the same time. And what I would say from this graph is that just the simple correlation here suggests there's little or no relationship with class size. However, if you don't look at that, looking at them one at a time can mask some relationships that don't pop out when you look at them just one at a time. For example, if class size is correlated with some other variable that works in the other direction, then that might, even though class size might matter, that correlation with other variables is confounding our ability to see that relationship. Now, that's a lot of technical jargon there, but the main point is that in a system where lots of things are going on all at one time and lots of them potentially matter in terms of effective education, looking at them like this, one at a time, is not an adequate approach to truly understanding which factors have an impact and which don't.
I appreciate that answer, and I think what we're talking about, as you point out, is that it's an abstract statistical profile. And so what we're going to try to do is put some faces on it, and we're going to be talking to people in the classroom that are dealing with people that seem to be reacting to that condition or not being able to react in a positive way to that condition.
Right.
But I appreciate the fact that what you're looking at right now is a statistical abstract, where you're trying to make all things equal, and you're trying to also make sure that you are looking at multiple factors, because we're all agreeing that multiple factors are involved in success or non-success in the teaching process. But what we're trying to do is to pull out something that seems to have been relevant to teachers, students, and parents who are the customers, you know, in this setting, as far as students and parents. But we'll come back to that.
Yeah, and let me be clear that we are trying to pull out the relevant factors, but this approach right here is not the right way to do it.
So we'll talk to you later about what is.
Right, and so I presented this because it was one of the things that was requested.
Absolutely, thank you.
And let me just make one more point on this is that, you know, one of the factors that has a very large impact on high school graduation is attendance rates. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that lower class sizes, contributes to engaging students better and improves attendance, then in that sense, class size may matter a lot. We just need to make sure that we understand the mechanisms by which it matters. And this graph here doesn't get us very far to understanding that.
And we understand that you haven't been able to finish all the reports either that may have some bearing on this as well. So thank you.
Right. So the next set of graphs are these bar graphs. And what I did for these is divide, and these are for elementary schools. These are at the school level, whereas the previous graphs were at the district level. And I broke all of the elementary schools in the state into size categories, and these are somewhat arbitrary. So I've got what are called very small schools. So those are schools with 50 or fewer students, and you can see in each bar is a school. So there's 16 schools in this very small category, and these are the class sizes the average class sizes in those schools. So they range from 1, which is sort of remarkable if you think about it, up to a little over 12. And so those are really small classes in these really small schools. And that's what I was referring to earlier when I talked about the extra money they get. Without that extra money, there's no way they could pull this off.
With a question in a small school, does this reflect, I mean, I'm again thinking blended classrooms, a lot of blended classrooms, or is there a way to disaggregate that out?
Well, there is a way to do that, but
folks, we're going to have to stand at ease for just a minute. Mr. Donovan needs to check with his boss about one thing. So if that would be okay, just stand at ease, and then we'll come right back. We will continue, and I think it might. I'm gaveling back in the meeting for Wednesday, July 27th, and this is the Task Force on Class Size. I think if it's okay, we're going to let Brian try to finish his three, and let's keep notes for ourselves, and then we'll ask questions as soon as he's done with his presentation.
Okay, so we're on the page showing the distribution of class sizes across elementary schools, and the second graph on that first page at the bottom is the next larger group that I've called small elementary schools, anywhere from 51 to 200 students. And you can see there's still a lot of variation in class sizes in that group, anywhere from under 10 up to in the high 20s. if you go to the back of that page, the next group, what I called medium, 201 to 400 students, a lot less variation here from, you know, about 17 up to the high 20s. So, and then the large group, even less variation, but still, you know, not trivial, but you know, from the low 20s up to the high 20s. And then when you get into the very large schools, which are those elementary schools larger than 600 students, even less variation. You're from about 22 up to 27. And I think there's really sort of two things here. Bigger schools have a lot more flexibility because they'll have multiple classrooms for each grade, and so they can balance those out and keep their averages, you know, sort of consistent. And in the smaller schools, the variation may be attributable primarily to size. I think Richard posted the actual data for that are behind these graphs. And so if you look at the small schools, it's in the ones that are in the 50 to 60 to up to about 100 students, where the class sizes are still down in the around 10 in the low teens. And then as you get over 100, they start getting up in the high teens and the low 20s. So there's still some size effects going on in that small group. And when you, by the time you get to the medium group, it's not so much about the size of the school that's affecting the class sizes. It's sort of the other circumstances that they face, whether, you know, the resource levels they have and so forth, or educational decisions they've made. So that's what I've got on, you know, of the data requested at the last meeting. That's what I was able to get done for today. And I guess the last piece that I have has to do with the quality education model. The model actually is based on what we call prototype schools. So the elementary school in the model is 340 students, grades K through 5. And so it would fall into the medium size group that I showed here. And what the recommendations are for class sizes in the model are 20 students in kindergarten and first grade, 23 in second and third grade, and 24 in fourth and fifth grade. Now that's a little bit below, if you look at back at that medium group, that's a little bit below where most of those schools are, below the sort of the midpoint of those. So the QEM is calling for slightly smaller class sizes in elementary schools than we actually see in a lot of our elementary schools. But it's also true that in a fair number of our elementary schools, class sizes remain pretty low, but it's mostly in the smaller ones.
Can we wait just till he finishes that, and then we'll have you go first?
So, and then just real quickly here, when we get into middle schools and high schools, we don't really talk about average class sizes because they're all over the map. We typically talk about trying to keep core class sizes below a certain level. And for middle schools, that, and I guess it's the same for high schools, that a maximum of 29 students in a core classroom where the original version of the model set that. And we haven't really looked into class sizes in depth over the life of the model. But if you look at look at core classes in high schools, you'll see that we're up in the 30s and even approaching 40 students in a lot of those classes. And so a lot of those classes are considerably higher than the model calls for in terms of a maximum. So, you know, still a fair amount of work to do in trying to get class sizes down to where the model is recommending them. But one of the things that's true is that reducing class sizes is one of the most expensive interventions that you can do in a school system. It just costs a lot of money to do that. So that's what I've got.
Paula, you're first.
So on the QEM, when you were talking about it, was it the medium-sized school? Is there breakdowns for the other schools, for the larger, or is it all based around that 340 students?
No, that the 340 is for elementary schools. For middle schools, it's 500, okay. And for high schools, it's 1,000.
So there's only 181 schools in our state that have that range. Our largest groups are large school at 254 elementaries, but we're basing it on the 181 schools, right?
So yeah, 181, pretty much.
254. So I've taught 28 years, and only 2 years out of the 28 have I gotten into this model of 20. I've only had 2 years under 20 out of 28 years. So that's a long time in Oregon's history of not even hitting a quality education model, not to mention now we have Common Core. But I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering why the 340 is the basis. Does that apply since our biggest group is the larger schools?
Well, the model is not... It's based on what research says is the most effective size of a school, not what we actually have in Oregon.
Okay.
And so it typically, or I guess what the model says, 340 students, that's about two classrooms for each grade in an elementary school with these class sizes. Mm-hmm. And so the model is really about what's most effective, not what we see on the ground.
So I guess what I was wondering about that was, is the QEM factor into the fact that the size of schools is a factor as well as the size of your classroom? You know what I mean? That's what I was trying to get a balance of, because it seems like they picked a model here of 201 to 400 students to base that class size on, but in Oregon we tend to have much larger elementary schools than that.
Right, and I mean, it's the model does look very carefully at, or very closely at, class sizes. It by using a sort of a prototype school approach where the schools are of a given size, it doesn't really take into account all the variation that we have in school sizes in Oregon, but it's in essence it's proposing that we be in these ranges and that we not have high schools that are 3,000 students and that we not have elementary schools that are 600 or 700 students.
Because it really changes on the graph, on the where that percentage breaks, you know, have 25 or more, or, you know, like two-thirds or one-third based on those schools. So if they're using that, I'm like, we're closer on the elementary and middle, but that's one of our smaller.
Well, and I'll tell you, the QEM is not based on this data. It's based on basically right. National research.
Okay.
Other questions that you might have for Mr. Reeder?
Yeah, I will go back and ask, you know, again, especially in terms of the smaller schools, there's no way to account, at least in what's presented, a blended classroom.
I didn't have time to try and look at breakdown grades and identify blended classrooms or two teacher classrooms. We can do that, but you know, we had a day long computer outage at ODE on Monday, so. No work was done on Monday on this, and so I was pressed to get out what I could. But we certainly can take a look at that.
Well, we really appreciate what you brought to us today, and I think it gave us a little bit larger scope of the ideas of what's out there for the quality education model. But the two things that I learned that I think are important for us to hang on to as we go forward in this work, and that is that when you look at the size of schools in the state of Oregon, you know, there are not too many high schools that are 1,000 or fewer, as Paula pointed out. There are not too many middle schools that are only 500. And the smallest school that I can think of, you know, in Hillsboro, there's out of, you know, 25 of them. there might be one or two that are at the small end where most of them are 400 or above. And so, you know, we're dealing with a reality of differences in the school size. And so when you've got larger schools, the impact between the class size and the school size is something I think we need to really consider and think about, and really trying to find some relationship there. So I'm just putting that out there because most of the work that I've read talk about the bigger the school is, the more important the relationships are, and the more important the kinds and sizes of classes that you're dealing with. I also want to point out and remind you, these are averages, and we have, you know, when you deal with averages, you're not dealing with also a reality of what's out there, even in core classes. And I will say that just 2 years ago, in my last year teaching after 42 years, my core class of English for seniors who were doing their senior project was 38 to 42. So, I look at these figures and I say, wow, where are you looking or finding these? Because the reality of what I saw out there was much larger. So, but that's just something for us to consider as we're going forward. We're trying to deal with the reality of what are the schools today, what are the sizes of the schools, what are the sizes of the classes that most teachers are having to deal with.
So. I'll just make one more point here. The fact that we have so many schools in Oregon that are larger than what the research says is the optimal size. And I think if you go back in history and look at the research on, you know, school size, there was this notion of economies of scale, that a larger school spreads certain fixed costs across more students, so the per student cost of running a large school is lower than running a small school. The problem with that research was that, and they said it's cheaper to run a school, that had nothing to do with how well you're serving kids. It had to do with sort of the day-to-day operations of doing, you know, doing what schools do. But the more recent research shows that larger schools, even though you're spreading your principal over more students, your principal cost and certain other staff costs over a larger number of students, the difficulties of connecting with students from really large schools are such that student outcomes don't get, they actually get worse in large schools. And so there's, you know, we've seen that really small schools cost a lot, and really large schools don't really have that benefit of economies of scale. So where's the optimal point? Where's the sweet spot that's where you get the most student learning for your buck? And the quality ed models estimates are based on that kind of research, and that's why they are where they're at. But I still think if you go to school districts around Oregon, and even our new schools, we're building big ones.
Well, thank you for that comment, and maybe to add to it, you know, our model is to get the best results for kids. We're not trying to make a profit. And so I think that's an investment that we've got to talk about. And again, you know, we have to be able to run them. We have to be able to have the money to staff them. But I think, you know, Brian, you point out a very important piece of factual information, that when we look at the quality education model, you know, what were the assumptions of what were the results that we were looking for? Were the results on just how to run a school, or were the results on really a cost-benefit analysis that had to do with money versus graduation rates, or money versus the ability to have open access for information for a variety of different learners? And I hope that that's something that we're going to discuss as we continue to talk about both class size and the quality education model. So thank you. Richard, did you have other...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brian mostly covered what I was going to talk about. I have a number of kind of data items that were left over from last week the committee asked for, and most of them were specific comparisons. So Brian came with the like school comparisons. Mm-hmm. And then I got questions here in committee and then from members kind of a couple by email asking to compare things based upon student characteristic broadly, like special ed student, English language learning student, things like that. How does class force impact those students? And there is not good data available on that. Part of it is that it is not possible to single out those students and put some of them in a large class and some of them in a smaller class and do a comparison study. That is not, it's not how teachers work. It's not how schools work. And so when we get down to asking about subgroup data in respect to class size, we do not have good data in that regard. But I think a lot of the anecdotal evidence is quite persuasive. The committee's already talked about that. Like Brian said, that when you're looking at one variable, perhaps there's no straight statistical correlation, but compounding variables tend to exacerbate each other. I think everybody understands that. That's all the only other thing I wanted to add in. And we did receive, I guess I should say one other thing. Last week, Jennifer Thompson from the Education Commission of the States testified. There were a couple of follow-up points that she wanted to send in to the committee members. So she sent a document. It's available on OLIS rather than didn't go through the document. It's just a follow-up to some of her things. And she, again, wanted me to highlight that document from Brookings that she thought was quite a valuable source of information that kind of brings together half a dozen or so articles on the topic.
So just one more point in that regard that you reminded me of is I did look back at some of the research that more recent research on class size. And most of it's been done by economists, which seems odd, but it's not really. And one thing that they do agree on, and they've done some kind of controlled research like Richard just described, where you see certain groups of students, for example, low-income students, who this group is in a large class and this group is in a smaller class. And there's fairly consistent evidence that smaller classes benefits low-income students more than it benefits higher-income students. So there is some evidence there for a particular group of students. I haven't seen any similar research on, for example, English language learners. Special ed is a very difficult one because for some of those students, they're in pull-out programs either all day or part of the day, and they're in regular classrooms part of the day. And sort of trying to understand what a good outcome measure is for we have such a broad range of special education students, from relatively mild disabilities to some rather severe ones, and trying to sort all that out and come up with a measure of what their student outcomes really are is a very difficult thing to do. But one thing that I would like to do is look more at some of the other groups of students, particularly ELL students, and maybe some breakdown by race and ethnicity, just to see whether we discern any impact of different class sizes on those groups.
I also want to take this time to, we have another member of this committee, Ann Bryan, who could not be here today, but she's going to watch the proceedings. And she sent in some information that she'd like to share with the rest of the committee. And one of them was an SREB policy brief that talks about smart class size policies for lean times. And it also actually gives at least a little bit of comparison between the states and talked a little bit about what some of the caps were for pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, grades 1 through 3, and grades 4 through 6. And there is a range there between the states that I thought might be interesting to some of you. So Richard will put that up on OLIS.
Yeah, Madam Chairman of the Committee, it'll be up in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
I should have had it up beforehand. That's my mistake. So it'll be up just very quickly.
But anyway, I think this is something we might all want to read and review before the next meeting, because I think it has some information that we've been asking for and some different questions that we had last time, as well as we were looking at the data of our own elementary and middle and high schools here in the state of Oregon. Okay, at this time then, are there any other questions that you have from the last meeting that you do not believe has been addressed? Okay, well, what we were going to try to do, talking about some of these anecdotal, you know, type of information that Richard was just talking about, and we have folks who are teachers here on the committee. We also have folks who have come to be invited testimony for us today, and I'll call on Robert in a little bit. But what I would like to do is, first of all, when you're talking from a statistical abstract like the ones that we've been discussing, sometimes with averages and with really trying to make everything the same. And the example that I would use would be special ed. Anybody who's been a teacher dealing with special ed in a classroom know the effects of large classes on special ed students, because we deal with it right up on the front line. Same with ELL and any other subgroup that you want to talk about. And we can give you information, examples, data, and some of us have been doing this for 42 years to 28 years to 15 years, and throughout those experiences there's a lot of comparisons, and there's also a lot of trends. And so I think it's real important for us to talk to practitioners and not just have a foundation of statistically neutral material, but actually have faces of teachers and students involved. And also in this data and this email that she sent to us, asked if we'd considered talking to students and would like to have on the record some students who have dealt with different sizes of classes. And we're going to try and do that. And so we'll go through the process of trying to invite some testimony of students that have had different experiences. I think Brian would appreciate the fact that we'll look for small schools, middle schools, and large schools, because, again, we're showing relationship between the size of the school and the size of the classrooms. But any other suggestions that you might have, like Ann did, on testimony or information or stories that we would like to put on the record to give us a fuller picture of what's happening in schools in the state of Oregon, we want to do that. And so we appreciate any input that you have. So I'd like to open it to folks, and it's not just teachers. It's also people who work in administration, it's people who work as aides, it's people who are in the classroom during the learning process. But I would like to offer the opportunity to anybody on the committee to talk about issues that they have concerns about around or integrated with class size, and give you an opportunity to share those ideas, concerns, or stories with the committee today. So I'd like to ask anybody who would be willing to share if they have something they'd like to discuss, or questions or ideas they'd like to share. Jessica?
I could start, I guess.
Sure.
I guess I could, if you're looking for those anecdotes, definitely. I feel like I've seen both ends of the spectrum on this, and I could probably speak to a little bit of my experience, my personal experience, in seeing class sizes fluctuate kind of wildly, and seeing what can happen when I was starting to face class sizes of pushing high 30s to 40, and even 42 at one point, I think. Luckily, in the last couple of years, my school has definitely put a focus on trying to get core class sizes back down, and I'm starting to see that benefit, but I did go for years in a room with some crazy rooms with crazy numbers. And what that meant for me...
Could you tell us where you taught?
Oh, yes, of course, sorry. I'm at David Douglas High School in the David Douglas School District, largest high school in the state. So what that meant for me in seeing those numbers spike after the economic downturn, after a needed reduction in force to make budgets, meant as a teacher completely having to change the way I ran a classroom. And at times felt like I was no longer teaching anymore, but conducting crowd management. I found that I couldn't, certain engagement strategies I couldn't use anymore because I had to consider floor space. I couldn't allow my students to get up and discuss and break up an 86-minute chunk of time the way I would have liked to in a way that I knew would be more beneficial to my students. Because I had to think about the fact that we felt like sardines in the room that we were in. And I think we've spoken to a little bit this idea of connections, and especially with high-need students, and especially in schools with a higher population of at-risk students, the ability to develop connections with those students is key. And as a teacher, managing a caseload of 220 as opposed to even, you know, 160 overall, I could give less and less personal feedback. I could have fewer conversations. If you look at 42 in a classroom in 86 minutes, that's not even 2 minutes you could spend with each student in that time. The effect for me was immediate and severe as a practitioner when I saw classroom numbers spike. So I guess that's what I would have to say about it in terms of my experience.
I appreciate that. And I'm going to be making a list of issues that deal with quality education and quality teaching and room sizes, because as Brian has brought up, we understand there's an integrated issue here. But when what you were talking about was how the class size affected your ability to teach, how the class size affected the student's ability to learn.
Absolutely.
And we want to try and look at it through those filters.
Yes.
So others that would be willing to share comments. Paula?
I think Jessica touched on something, too, for me about changing of your teaching style, like what you had to do in management pieces of it. I teach in Centennial School District. I'm a kindergarten teacher. I've also taught in North Marion out in Aurora. That's where I started my career for 11 years. What I and my children, my own children, are went through my same school district. So I get to see it through their perspective as well, and I know where the gains and losses were with my own children from all the cuts and all the hits that education has taken. And all three of them had very different experiences in school simply because of the economic times. For example, both my daughters took part in outdoor school, but my son never got to. Both my girls had lower elementary class sizes, but my sons were in blends almost every other year because class sizes were so big. So his experience is very different than my daughter's. And that's the district I work in. But my school is a high poverty school, over 80%. We have free breakfast and free lunch for all students because the poverty level is so high. And our ELL population is very high. And we are fully inclusive. So our SPED numbers have gone through the roof like mid-year, two-thirds into the year. They finally acknowledged it was just too much and they put another teacher in to do SPED, a regular classroom teacher to become a SPED teacher simply because there were no SPED teachers available. But it took that long to get some action to help with those numbers. So it's like we're constantly reacting to things and we're not at all looking at a proactive approach to educating children anymore. It's we wait until, the walls cave in and then we react instead of building the walls stronger. So when I look back, I think now I run my classroom, a kindergarten with five-year-olds in a very first grade, second grade approach, which means academics, academics, academics. You don't get choice because choice often causes chaos when there's too many in the room. And so what I'm seeing is kids who don't really know how to make good choices in their life because we strip that away from our youngest learners because it's not safe in our environment with that many kids to let them choose. And what happens long term with that is then you have more problems when they're in fourth and fifth grade. Academically, maybe my kids are coming out of kindergarten looking pretty good. Common Core said read a level six. I'd say two-thirds of them are there. But that's really not the best place for kids because the best place for kids is for them to learn all those social and emotional skills, and then the academics can get built into that. So what I'm finding, certainly as I watch my kids go through my building, is that the larger class sizes forces us to be really tight in our boundaries so that we cannot lose control, and that means we take away the kids' choice of control. And my principal said it as well. We're dealing with issues in fifth and sixth grade that probably should have been settled in kindergarten and first grade, but they never had that opportunity because that was kind of taken away from them. And the other thing is, in our class sizes in our district, kindergarten, when you get to 27, then they look at
bringing someone in to help you. In first and second grade, the classes can go up to 30 and above. And in third through sixth grade, it's 34 is pretty much the norm. And that's really high, considering three through six are your state benchmark years. And that's where all the testing they want to do for children. So, and I feel like our district's really conscious of trying to lower the class sizes. They keep trying to put it back into kindergarten, and they'll do it, but we can't control the population that moves in. So if one year I have, you know, 27 kids in my room, I have 27 in my room, and they'll hold me right there. So, and that's been happening. Like I said, I've only had 2 years under 20 in 28 years. So that's a little bit about my district, and Rob's here from my same district, so he'll talk about high school and middle school numbers. They've gone way up as well, but from the elementary perspective, those kind of things about taking away, making academics and choice away from children is really critical, I think, to some of the younger classes, and we're not treating them as the whole child needs to be taught when you educate a child, so...
I would like to offer also an opportunity for you, if you have anything you want to write down or email in as far as statistics, to make sure that we did get them, as far as your class sizes or things like that. That's also helpful for the record, and I would appreciate that support if we can do that.
So I teach second grade in Forest Grove. You know, I will say that... I will have a opportunity with meeting those relationship types of things much easier, and I believe that those are the critical things that we do. One of the most critical things that we have left out on our conversations around education and academics, I guess, is that whole notion of rigor and relevance, and we've heard rigor and relevance stressed, and that goes to the point of having a very narrowed curriculum or a focused curriculum on reading and math, and to speak to Paula's point, those choices become very limited for our kids, and yet. We know how important relationship is, and for far too long that's been the R that's been left out in those conversations of rigor, relevance, and relationship, right? Too many, and when I have 25, 24 kids, much easier to build that. When I have 28, 32, hard to find seats for, you know, when I taught fourth grade for all those 30 general, like, desks and arrangement and what can you do from an instructional practice, it does change, and it definitely impacts again that aspect of meeting our kids' needs, and on top of that. Add in the assessments that are the marker that we use all too often as the data point of whether or not we're being successful or not with student learning, and whether our kids are making gains. And I just honestly believe that the more time you can spend with kids, one-on-one, small group, the better your outcomes will be. And I've seen it at younger ages, preschoolers. I mean, would you ever imagine having preschoolers of over 20 and second grade or kindergarten over 20? But yet that's a common occurrence. 29, I had colleagues, 30 in kinder classes. And yes, you know, our district provided supports to help alleviate that, IAs, you know, reading small group kinds of things. But yet, at the end of the day, those aren't ongoing all the time, and you're a classroom of 29, 30 kinders. On top of that, with now the kinder assessments, again, we'll get too into the weeds with assessment, but that is time consuming just by sheer, you know, doing it. But then when you add the volume of the number of kids that are in our elementary classrooms, it's inundating, just a big burden pile of on top of our profession. Certainly doesn't allow for quality teaching. And what I would love to be able to look at as the whole child.
Thank you very much.
I also think with that comes, yes, like the poverty piece of this, mm-hmm. the students that come in and their needs as well. I mean, until this next coming year, our counselor has been in each classroom, not available for families or students because she's been teaching these other classes. But two things rang out for me. One, the relationships. I love that you shared that because it is one of the R's that we've totally left off focusing. And I know that my students who went to the high school, which was very crowded, they would share with me that the best relationships they've had with their teachers always happened in passing, not in the classroom, but when they're in the hall. Like, they'd stop by Rob's room, hey, and he's like, why are you looking so down? Like, a teacher would notice it. It couldn't happen when the door's shut because they had so much curriculum to face on. There were so many kids. But the passing time in a high school hallway, in a middle school hallway, has been critical for students because it's the one time when they get to have, like, that little glimpse of a relationship. And passing time is, what, 5 minutes, 7 minutes? Not enough with 2,000 students in a building. And then the other last thing is someone said, well, I think Brian shared it, it costs a lot of money to lower class sizes, granted, because you have to hire staff, and we cost a lot of money. But we are education. We are the ones that are going to deliver the education. We're going to be building the relationships. And so when they said, we're spending too much money on staff, I'm like, where else do you want to spend it? I mean, a textbook's not going to teach the child. The textbook is not going to come to life for the child just because you put it in front of them. It's the educator. So for me, when they say it costs a lot of money, and then they come back and say, well, we spend 89% of our budget on staff, you should be. We're not a business. We're educators, and all of your money, you shouldn't be making money. You should be putting it right into the staff to help those students. And so for me, I feel like that cost piece needs to be celebrated. Like, yeah, we're spending a lot of money. We should spend a lot of money and get the best staff in there for our students and get those numbers down to a decent size. So
I appreciate that. Richard, did you have a comment or a question?
I had a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's atypical for committee staff but to chime in. But I'm listening and I'm hearing you folks describe what I would consider techniques of veteran or experienced teachers. Like, I'm not an educator, so I don't really know, but it seems like these are things that you have learned, like you are skilled practitioners. And what comes up oftentimes in education committees, which I also staff, is professional challenges, and I'm interested to hear about professional challenges that increase class size place on you as practitioners, especially maybe for your colleagues that are newer teachers. I'm just interested to know how you as professional educators experience, I don't want to shift away from kids and perhaps, but, you know, just as professionals, how do you experience the impacts of class sizes?
Time is huge, and I think especially looking at newer teachers and the kind of time you have to put in just to figure out curriculum, just to map out what you're going to do, and really think through all of those things that don't come naturally. Yet, if you look on top of that, the kind of time it requires, and I'm an English teacher, so any English teacher knows what kind of time goes into feedback. And I could, you know, for example, I have 150 of my students turn in an essay that I want to give timely feedback to them. I spend, you know, 10 minutes reading and giving feedback per essay. You can do the math on that. And so that goes up exponentially. And so it's, I think that kind of time you have to put in can be hard on a veteran teacher, but even more so on somebody who is already completely overwhelmed time-wise as they're trying to get themselves established, for sure.
I feel like mentoring programs in school has been left up to each district, which really shouldn't be the case because we have a high turnover in teachers because they don't have the supports that they need. And so, like in our case, our association has picked up the ball. our union association to give mentoring to our newest teachers because we know they need it. I feel like that should be there should be a mentoring program that's set up by the state as well. They've invested a lot of money. These kids are in college, so there isn't a mentoring program. So I do think the support for our new teachers is critical, and we've dropped the ball on that completely. Our turnover for sped teachers, there's a message to us. We have one of the highest, I don't know about the other districts, but in my district, every year we're hiring sped teachers because every year they're like, I can't do it anymore. So what's happening there? Like, why are we not looking at that group as well? So there is definitely the veteran teacher. We're feeling this. I know I look at my 23-year-old teacher who's new to first grade, and thank God she's just young and has a lot more energy because, I mean, she should be overwhelmed because we just keep layering things on her. But, you know, when you're 23, you tend to have a little more energy than when you're a little bit older like me. So she can handle a lot of it, but I'm there with her every step of the way. Like, I'm mentoring her every step, and that's all in my own time because I care about her. I think she's got phenomenal skills to be a teacher, and right now she's struggling because she has 31 first graders in her classroom, and she's a brand new teacher right out of college. So
I would agree for our newer teachers. Time is such a critical, valuable resource to have, and yet you have so little of it. Just like Jessica was saying, learning the school culture, for that matter, on top of planning and mapping and becoming more in tune with the daily work of what we do. And mentoring is essential. It happens informally sometimes in buildings, building by building, grade level teams. Sometimes it happens with partnerships, state level grants made available. And yet, I think one of the things we have to be aware of, cognizant in this way, because time is such an essential piece of what we're always looking for as educators, and especially again for new educators, the time needed for mentorship and PD, it can get just on top of, oh, that's another hour out of my whatever I'm going to be losing because I'm having to mentor program. So be, yes, we need it. Yes, it's absolutely critical and valuable. But as those programs are put forth and implemented, be aware that our new teachers and teachers in general, being out of the classroom is not a thing that we, you know, classroom. We want to be with our kids, and those are my colleagues who serve on different committees and different types of leadership capacities within our districts. Sometimes that takes them out of the classroom, and that's a hindrance as well. You know, just like coming down and testifying during the school year, that's a hindrance. We don't want to be out of our classroom. It's hard to imagine, again, the new teachers who have so much to do and so little time, and then asking them to do more.
Well, I appreciate that comment. I want to make sure that we understand that we're giving personal experiences, we're talking about our own classrooms or our former classrooms, and we understand that this is, you know, our stories. I would like to add, I believe from what I just heard from the three of you and from the question that Richard asked, and that is both new and experienced professional teachers are being impacted by class size. And I think that statement in itself is something that we need to acknowledge and try to figure out how to assist those teachers being able to do their quality education job. The question that Richard asked was, how does that class size affect our ability to be quality teachers? And I want to give three or four from 42 years of my classrooms. And that is, number one, learning style. A student has a learning style. Depending on how many students that are in the classroom, I can adapt and or have four or five variations of the lesson plan for those students, depending on how much time I have to address each of those students and their type of learning and their best type of learning style, and really assist them. If there's more students in the classroom, then that means that there's more variations and there's more students to actually address in different ways so they can be successful. That doesn't happen in those larger classes. The second one besides learning style is techniques. I had to learn when I had a speech class, and I had speech, English, psychology, senior seminar, and I had range of students from 9th to 12th grade. And as far as techniques, when you have a class of speech kids, 42 of them, then you have to shorten your speech from 3 to 8 minutes, even though that vehicle doesn't give them the same opportunity to use and strengthen skills, either in writing or speaking. And you don't get to give them feedback, don't have the same tactics you can use. So half of that class will give that presentation in front of the class. The other half will give it on tape in the back room, and the teacher will take home 25 taped speeches to listen to that night and the next night, and by the third or fourth day will be able to give back feedback to those students on the speeches that they gave. So the feedback loop is longer, and the feedback loop is not as efficient or effective or as personal, because you have to do it through other tactics or techniques that allows you to survive in a classroom of 40 to 42 kids. Another one is safety, and I think it's really important. In a class of seniors where you might have, you know, I had in this one class actually quite a few boys in this one class, and in a very large class, probably two-thirds of them were boys. And it was an English class, and the class was crowded, and you have senior boys who are, you know, 17 years old. Somebody knocks a cap off of somebody's head, and we have a full war safety issue. We have kids on the floor. We have blood all over the classroom. We have a cracked wall. We have the teacher's desk moved because there were so many kids in that classroom that they were uncomfortable, and there was a safety issue with some really nice kids. They're good kids, but it was a safety issue just over the space we were in and how cramped they felt and overwhelmed with how close they were and people were in their bubble or their space. Now, there are other safety issues that are much more serious, but just that simple, that you are so close in a classroom that students can't really tolerate the bubble being burst. The last one that I think is really important, and that is, again, on relationships. There's a situation where we're trying to figure out how, again, with the different learning styles, do you create relationships for students that need to have more space in their learning. I had a homeschooled student who couldn't actually work in that space, so I had to find another space for her to work where I could still observe her. And so there's a lot of issues as far as space and safety and learning style techniques and abilities to function in that classroom at your very best, so that the student has an opportunity to have access to the very best learning. So I don't know. I feel like that's just sort of the base of, we've got to look through how do we give the students the best opportunity to be successful. I just wanted to put myself on the record for that. Any other comments before we ask our invited guest? Robert, would you like to join us up here at the end of the table? And I'm going to let Robert introduce himself and what he teaches, where he teaches, and some of the experience he's had that relates to class size and effective teaching.
Well, Representative McLean, Task Force, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, big guy in a small chair. Okay, here we go.
Use a different chair.
Oh, I'm good. thank you, though. Let's see. I'm Robert Havrilla. I'm a high school social studies teacher at Centennial High School. My neighbor over here. And then I've taught everything from AP U.S. History to what we call success, the kids who are struggling. So I've taught it all. The only thing I haven't taught is psychology in our department. I've been doing it for going on 17 years. now at Centennial High School. And Centennial High School is a high poverty, majority-minority district. Of almost 1,900 kids, very energetic kids, and in all honesty, an amazing staff doing what they do with the kids, with resources that we have. When I found out I was going to be here today, I was asked to come here and give my experience. I looked at it as an opportunity not to just give my experience, but for the experience at our school. So I called 8 other teachers in our building, several other different departments, the math department, science department, English department in particular, one art teacher for 1,900 students, and PE departments, and another AP teacher. I did this to compare their experiences with my own and give you a more inclusive and more fully comprehensive look. And I asked them the one question, how does class size impact the student experience in the classroom? And we all had the same 5 answers. And almost every single one of them I've heard here from the teachers at on this task force. So it's kind of, it's not new information, but it is to say, yes, this is my experience also. The first thing and most common was you were just talking about. The students are unable to get the timely and quality feedback that they need for sustained learning. Most of us have caseloads of about 200 kids. We've had years where it's 210, 220. Sometimes a little less. If you have a little less, it's more challenging students in general. But we have 6 51-minute classes. So if I give a paragraph out, if I'm preparing a kid to write an essay, I'm going to start paragraphs. So if I assign a paragraph, and let's say it takes me a couple minutes to read that paragraph, assess what I want to, what feedback I want to get, and maybe a minute to or two. So 3 minutes per paragraph. It is impossible for me to, for all my classes, of classes of 35 to 40 students each, to get that paragraph back and get that timely feedback to that student the next day. It's impossible to do that. Now, you were talking about, Jessica, you were talking about essays. The same thing. But now you're talking more 25, 30, 35 hours worth of work. So now that I get to give those back, am I going to meet with the student? Am I just going to simply hand it back and let them read it and let them figure it out? Or am I going to call them up and when am I going to do that? When am I going to have the time to do that? After I hand it out, go over the general impressions, and now I have 35 to 40 students in a 51-minute class, how am I going to have those kids come up to my desk and have a conversation with each one of them about their writing? Let's see here. This is not including all the administrative demands on the teacher. The teacher working with students on IEPs, which you obviously are going to have to spend more time with those kids, or the English language learners. Because, and as an aside, we have 53 different primary languages spoken in our school last year.
How many?
53. That was the last number I heard. It changes from year to year. One of our math teachers pointed out for him that it's just not mathematically possible to teach a math skill in a class of 35 to 40 students, have the students demonstrate that skill, and have them turn in an exit slip on their way out and be able to see whether or not, determine whether or not that student can demonstrate that skill. It's just mathematically impossible in a class of 35 to 40 students. So that's the first impact, the feedback. The second impact that class size has is less learning opportunities for the student. You're talking about all this time to write an essay. We have an English teacher who told me, look, as the states increase the demands on the essays, is at the same time the class sizes have exploded. And because the class sizes have exploded, I have to reduce the number of times that I offer essays. So the kids actually have less opportunities as the state's increased their expectations. The students actually have less opportunities to learn those expectations. Every teacher pointed that out, that they offer less opportunities because there's more students, it's just not enough time in the day. The third impact that class size has on the students is instruction becomes more teacher-driven. That's something that we've heard here, too. Instruction becomes more teacher-driven. In a larger classroom, teaching becomes less individual, more directed towards the large group. A science colleague pointed out that learning becomes less hands-on in his classroom. Just in terms of space, there's not enough lab space for each student. And another reason is that in terms of classroom management, which we just heard, our PE, the fourth one, is safety, which we've also heard about today. Our PE and science teachers in particular spoke at length about this. Science teacher, you put a science teacher in a class of 35 to 40 students with, or in a chemistry lab, and some interesting things can happen. Also, PE. We cap our PE classes at 48 students, but a cap is, I'm not sure why they call it a cap. It's a wish list. It sometimes goes over 50. And you put that many students in a weight room with one teacher. The teacher's looking over here, and these kids are in this weight. That's a safety concern. That's definitely a safety concern. We all spoke to this, but this is very personal to me, and Jeffrey was speaking to this, and this one's very important. The needs of each student gets lost. I'm going to read a little bit more here in this one. I personally had the experience that I find out that I have a student who's homeless, has a parent in prison, a parent going to prison, are the only working member of the family. They've been subject to different types of abuse, or they're harming themselves, or they have a learning challenge that has not yet been identified. And I find this information out later than I should in a larger classroom. Sometimes I find out too late in a larger classroom. That, to me, maybe that's not the most politically correct thing to say, is the most important. Because we should be looking at the whole student. I agree with Jeffrey when he said that we absolutely ignore the relationship space. There is nowhere in our standards that talks about relationship. I think class sizes, if a school was graded on the relationships and class size, I think you would see, as they are test scores, I think you would see class size become much more of an issue. I have a colleague who works in Washington who left Centennial. And that's the other thing, is turnover. Turnover is amazing right now. Now that people can get hired other places, I have many colleagues who've left Vancouver where they do have caps. He talked to me that he says, my administrators are more worried about class size than I am. And how is that? Well, because it costs for every student after 180, it costs them money, and so they get really concerned if it gets over 100. And they came to me and said, "I'm really sorry, I have another student that's going to put you at 185. I really don't mean to do this to you." He says, "I came from a school where I had 224. Okay, you know, he said he would never come back. That's a concern. That's going to what you were talking about, the teacher experience class size. So the state of Oregon has increased the demands on the teachers and the students. And each, the teachers and the students, have adapted to those demands. It would be outstanding if the state also adapted with those demands. With the adjustment in demands, should come an adjustment in resources. And most everybody here is in education, so I was going to offer, I was expecting more representatives here. But just if they're listening, if anyone would ever like to join me in my classroom, I would love the experience. And not only just join me in a classroom for a day, but what I would do is be able to put them in classroom in different departments with different teachers so they can have a different experience. Thank you.
Robert, thank you for coming today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your summer to come and talk to us about this important issue. Did anybody have any comments or questions that they wanted to ask Robert?
I do. So I was glad that you talked to other departments because that's, you know, the core teachers. We already talked about that as really critical, but, you know, they don't think of PE as core, but I know that that's been a factor with that large of a number. But the basic needs that you talked about, I know in your high school you did a survey that asked students trying to find out dropout rate back in Western Principal's Day, and they did a survey with all the students, and they said that the relationships was a really big part of it, and that basic needs, we keep trying to go there. It's like that, we know that's important, and we keep trying to go there, and I feel like your building with that number, has that been, because I don't do the high school, has that slowly increased, or has jumped and stayed there? Like, I can't remember
What has jumped and increased?
Your class sizes.
Oh, the class sizes have jumped and increased in the last 7 years. It's about seven years? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, since we laid off a little over 20% of our staff when everything hit. And I remember that day well. And we have not added any FTE back. As a school, we're still in financial crisis. The positions that are being added back are at the grade schools. And I think the middle school's gotten a couple. But the high school's not really a focus. And I think that's true of many of my colleagues in other districts as well. So we are still very much in financial crisis.
Thanks.
Financial crisis is the normal.
The other important issue that I thought you brought up was the fact that there are some schools that have many, many more languages than others. And you said 53, and I met a teacher the other day that was in a similar situation in a different district. How do you deal with some of those? Do you have, for example, a strategy on how you bring a student that may have a second language issue that they cannot? How big are your ELL classes, I guess is what I'm saying?
Our ELL classes are fairly small. I want to say they're right around 20, I want to say. And I work closely with the ELT. We have an amazing ELL staff, by the way. We really do, if you ever want to talk to some people that are outstanding. They do a great job with limited resources. And they are very pushy with the mainstream teachers. They are very pushy, which they should be, to make sure that their kids are being met. So one thing I do, what I do is I meet with Reed, he's one of the ELL teachers, and say, okay, what's the story? You know, who is this kid? What, you know, what's he able to do right now? And the first thing I do is look at the writing. If everything we do right now is writing. Look at the writing and see where they're at. There's some kids that it's going to be a long haul. There's other kids that, wow, so, where'd you learn that? So that's how I approach it. We work closely with our EL department. We also work closely with our special ed department. We have a guy, Jeremy Williamson, that's amazing.
I think in our district we've educated and trained all of our teachers in PSYOP and GLAAD, so
that's
we
right.
use those strategies. So in high school,
Sorry.
Every high school teacher is also ELD trained through PSYOP, and in elementary it's GLAAD, and we do have good ELD teachers that work with our newcomers and things like that. But they are fully mainstreamed into your classrooms. And
thank you, Paul. Yeah,
I do think you were going there, but I just thought you should know that they do. Our district has put a lot of money into ELD, and I think they've done a good job doing that, and they've put money into training us. So
maybe that is one area.
I wasn't going there, actually, because I did, in all honesty, I thought it was second nature. I guess I take it for granted.
Because we've always had it.
I guess I take it for granted because it's just a natural. I have to even utilize those strategies. But that's not a, in all honesty, those strategies are not just good for English language learners. They're good for kids in poverty. They're good for kids, I mean, it's just some of the strategies are.
I think what we notice is the communication with parents is really difficult.
Oh, yes.
And building a relationship with those families makes it a lot more difficult because we are, as a staff, not of that ethnic background. So that's one of the areas I think in Centennial we struggle, trying to find a way to integrate that community more with us so that we can, you know, we have to bring translators. We purchase them from all over during conference time to come in, and you'll see a whole stream of people that have never worked in your building translating your conferences and things like that. And that's always kind of difficult because, you know, again, you want that relationship. And now you don't want to just spill information to them. You want to know who they are, the heart of them. So that part of it.
I had a student who a Spanish-speaking student who was being very challenging. And I said, look, I'm going to have to meet with your parents. He goes, do you speak Spanish? I don't think so. That sucks for you. And he's just, but we just hired a kid across the hall that I'm kind of mentoring, 24 years old, Mr. Perez, who does speak Spanish. And so Mr. Perez helped me call home and helped the parents come in. And actually, that young man did very well in the class after that. but the language issue is a big...
Thank you very much. So at this point, I really appreciate everybody who's shared their story and, you know, put on what we're trying to do is look through the filter of class size and how it relates to many other issues as far as success for students and for quality education and quality teaching. So I appreciate the stories, and Robert, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. Have a nice day.
Talk to you soon. I know if Hannah was here, we often hear her story, and hopefully she'll call in because we have a kindergarten teacher in the state of Oregon who had 56 kindergartners. She was a brand new first-year teacher with 56 kindergartners by herself. And it's a story that every time I hear it, I just shiver in my boots because I'm like, wow, 56 kindergartners and you're a first-year teacher. So to me, that was interesting information, and hopefully we can get to Hannah because she knows a lot about the circumstances of class size, and she's followed it as well. So hopefully she's sending things in.
Thank you.
She's gone right now.
Well, what I'm going to try to do, because those of you who have come to the meetings 1 and 2, I really appreciate it. And we are going to do a Google Doc again and try to get people to recommit. And also my staff, Nicole, she and I are going to either call every member on the committee. And we do understand some folks are from Pendleton, and that's a long haul. And so we really are going to encourage either Skyping or on the phone or anything we can do to get people to participate long distance and try to make sure we've got more voices and more listeners around the table. And so we hope to do that for the next meeting. The next meeting is August 2nd. And I would like to ask if there is any other possible topics or questions that you would like to see on the agenda for further discussion or for more data or more information before we go on to how we're going to handle looking at these issues, how are we going to handle looking for some good advice and suggestions to people who are working on these issues here in the legislature or the Department of Ed or throughout our school districts. So if I could get some comments about that, I'd really appreciate it. Jeff?
I would like to see some information around blended classrooms. I know that it impacts what I do in the classroom and how I teach and what I teach especially. I would like to see some blended classroom impacts of that, please.
Can I ask Jessica a question first?
Yes.
Jessica, on the QEM, it said a 29 max for core classes. Are you at Douglas close to that?
It depends.
I forgot to ask Rob.
Yeah, no, it depends on the class, because we're in the last 2 years I've seen administration try to shift resources I think right now more towards language arts and math So I've seen my classes personally go down, but I know that's not the case in our science classrooms just yet, or in our social studies classes just yet, and definitely not in our electives yet. So it's there's a range right now. I personally, teaching juniors, which is where our numbers really start to drop, I'm under that now, this year. I wasn't always. I mean, even 2 years ago, I wasn't, but this last year, I finally dropped under there. But I can't say that's the case for all of our core teachers right now.
So I would like us to do, maybe next time, just knowing that a little bit, is if the QEM is what we've looked at, and we've have that, and you reported the numbers today, which was great, and I wrote them all down, I'd like to figure out how we can get to this. How are we going to get to the quality of education model? It's time. It's been sitting out there for too long. And if we can't do anything else, then let's get that piece of class size figured out. It's got rocks. It's got numbers attached to it. So I would like to see how we can move a discussion to not just saying there's a QEM out there, but actually living under the QEM.
Thank you. I wonder, too, to speak to that, also kind of, we presented information on other states and other places where they were simply putting caps. Like, that seemed to be their answer. It was very clear that that was a fudgeable number, right? That a cap wasn't always a hard and fast number in these states, which makes me curious if there are places using alternative methods that aren't necessarily just putting a cap on classes or where knowing that money isn't always a guarantee, are there places looking a little bit outside the box and how to fix the issue and how to get under the QEM?
Yeah. Actually, Washington just passed, what they passed in Washington with their class size was something similar to that. They have a suggested cap, but if it goes over, then the teachers get paid more, or they bring another, you know, they have some alternative things that fit in with it, but they have a number to start with. So that'd be good to look at. I don't really know all of what they came up with, but...
Thank you. That's great. It was on my list, too. So both of those actually really relate to what I hope the goal and of the committee, you know, is, which is to move us forward in looking for solutions for what look to be very integrated issues, graduation rates, dropout rates, absenteeism, safety, ability to use good techniques, and be able to really react and relate to learning styles, and allowing good teaching and good learning to happen in our classrooms. That's the goal, is not just to look at the number, but to try and figure out how to either look outside of the box or how to give incentives for people to look at class sizes as a very important element, or how to deal with financial issues. But we need to move forward. I really agree with that, Paula, and I thank you for that.
I'd also maybe, and maybe I'm out of bounds here, but Representative McLean, you just brought up some very interesting pieces that Brian also alluded to, and I think we all have in one way or another, which is, again, all these competing factors that impact what we do in public education. I believe strongly that choice is one of them, right? The number of choices and opportunities, reducing absenteeism, keeping kids engaged, different learning styles, decreasing class sizes in core places where you have more electives. So to that end, I would love to know or see if there's any information on what types of electives are being offered in our high schools, and do they vary based on size of the high school? Just again, I'm curious in that way.
Well, I'm going to add to that, because that's really interesting at the high school level, because they're trying to get the core classes down, but we also know that we need to engage. And we need to have variety for kids to have good career paths that are varied. And we have a push to go back to STEM. You know, those electives that were wood shop and automotive and greenhouse and dealing with some of those other topics, how many of them have been dropped? You know, so how many, you know, to that, Brian, how many actual electives are still out there? Home ec has been dropped. Now, home ec had chef. We had a lot of chefs come out of our school for a while because we had a really engaging type of program that dealt with actual food and other elements of the restaurant and service industry. But we're saying we want to bring STEM back, and yet if we bring STEM back or we put more money towards STEM, you know, again, those choices that Jeff's talking about, have we actually looked at if we're in balance or out of balance? Because we have some districts that are dropping a lot of electives and bringing down some core sizes, and then they have dropout and absenteeism issues. So we're really, you know, that balance with all of this. We're not saying class size is the only factor. We're saying that class size becomes even more of an issue when you have some of these other choices being made. So, you know, there's this balance. I know this is hard stuff, and if we knew how to do it, we'd copyright it, right? And then we'd send it out. But I think we can't walk away from the hard conversations. And that's what we don't want to do.
But I feel like a lot of the core stuff can be taught through those courses as well. You know, maybe in the past we didn't look at doing papers in our home ec class, but we can now. I mean, we understand what the learning curve is and what the standard is, and you can incorporate it wherever we want, but we haven't looked at putting those back. And the other thing is that I think there's a mandate that PE must be full, we must be doubling our PE minutes in the next year, 2 years, which worries me only because it's not funded again. So they're going to give the schools money, but they're going to say, but don't forget, now you must, I mean, we do have it this year. Our district has opted to go to full day PE, but we haven't had it for years. So these are the things we compete against, and our district starts panicking over there, like, well, we can't do this because we're going to have to do PE soon, so we got to have money for that. So really being careful, like when we're looking at these electives, let's get them back in, but let's start figuring out how to be creative with those mandates. I mean, I think there's some great ways to spend the money and tie in standards and things. So
good comments. And Richard and Brian, do you feel like you have an idea of some of the questions that we've asked? And,
yeah.
Okay.
I think those are pretty specific questions.
Yeah. Okay. And, okay, at this point then, Richard's going on vacation, and nice. We're happy for him. He gets to take his brand-new child, well, not totally brand-new.
9 months.
9 months old, back to visit with extended family. Aww. And so we will have another staff member here this next time.
Probably my colleague, Victoria,
okay.
Who does the House Higher Ed Committee, so the other education person.
And we are going to make a real effort, Nicole and I, to really try to get as many people here for that August 2nd as possible. We hope you folks will be here. We appreciate you being consistent with us. And anything that you have at this point, Nicole is in my office. We have Richard and Victoria. So you can call either one of those two offices, and either Richard or Victoria would be available to you. And Nicole and I will work hard on trying to make sure we've got more folks in the classroom.
As another option too, the next meeting on August 2nd, on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th is the OA board meeting. And so they're coming from Pendleton, Ashland, all over the state for our board meeting. So if you're looking for any more speakers or anything, it might be they're going to be traveling up anyway. I know the Pendleton, he'll be here because he's coming up the next day anyway. So it's a great opportunity for us on that date to maybe utilize some of the smaller districts from down south or different areas you might want to pull from. So
thank you.
So I'll be here.
Thank you very much. Okay, anything else for the good of the order?
We're meeting at 2 o'clock.
That's what we said.
On the 2nd, I believe.
We're going to check that just to be absolutely sure.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's what was agreed on. We can do 2 o'clock.
So we're inviting colleagues to testify. Can I be safe in saying be here at 2? You'll probably be an hour-ish, couple hours. I mean, I guess it depends.
I think 2 to 4 is what we were, you know, as the longest would probably be. That's what we've gone under that pretty much. We had to start a little bit late today. So that would be good, I think. Also, I want to address the issue that, you know, school starts in-service starts, and then I know we have issues with getting teachers here. I want this committee to continue to work after our report out, which our short report out are really going to be a list of what is the problem, you know, as we see it and at what we've heard or what we've discussed, and then how do we go forward to look for those solutions, and here's a list of things we're thinking about. And so, you know, we would like to have at least maybe one or two more meetings in August, depending on what we can do, so that we get away from the teacher going back to the classroom problem. Is that sound realistic to you folks? And we'll also ask people on August 2nd.
As soon as August rolls around, it gets booked, but yeah. Certainly can do our best. And I would always phone in if I couldn't make it. But
and I appreciate that. And then also, you're not being reimbursed for mileage or for your time, I know. And that's because of the kind of committee we are. We're a task force. And so I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you. And I hope you'll think toward your professional organizations and maybe see if they see you as someone who's carrying some of that weight or some of that message for them, and you can find some support there. But I just want you to know how much I want to acknowledge what you're doing. And I know for me it's a 61-mile round trip, and I know for many of you it's much, much further. 61 miles one way, whatever that is. Okay, so over 122 or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's I just want to acknowledge that and tell you how much I really appreciate what you're doing and doing for kids, because I know that's why you do it. So thank you very much. And we will work hard on doing a Google Doc and getting it out there to the full committee and see what we can come up with. So thank you.
Thank you.
Let me say one thing real quick.
Yes.
So we have to generate this short report in the text of the bill by the 15th of September. I, and perhaps Nicole, but I will kind of do a draft and to get folks started. And then you will edit the draft as you see fit, and the committee will vote to adopt it. Whatever the final meeting of, like today there's less than a quorum in the room and on the phone, whatever the final meeting, hopefully most of the committee will have to have a quorum procedurally, and will vote to adopt the report, and that's kind of the mechanics of how a report gets generated by the committee.
And I want you to know that I'd be willing to have a night meeting or even a Saturday meeting, which, you know, I don't want people to have to give up family time, but I would be willing to do that and ask staff if it's possible.
Sure.
And then we would try to make sure we've got that quorum here to really have a full discussion on what that report is. Mm-hmm. Does that sound reasonable?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today. And I would like to adjourn the meeting for July 27th. Thank you. July 27th. Thank you.